on the call is In Re Estate of Larson. And I'm waiting for my screen to show lawyers participating. We've got two signed in. And I'll ask the bailiff, has everybody signed in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. So the next case on the call is In Re Estate of Larson. The Chief Justice is recused. I will preside. My name is Lindsay Miller Lerman. I'm a justice on the Nebraska Supreme Court. And following my introduction, I'm going to ask the other members of the court in order of seniority to introduce themselves prior to the beginning of oral argument. Justice Castle.
Good morning. William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy.
Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik.
And John Frydenberg.
Thank you. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Other members of the court, are you able to hear counsel?
Yes.
Okay, I think we're good to go. And sir, do you see the clock?
I do, and I would like to attempt to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right, the bailiff's informed he would like to reserve 2 minutes. Thank you.
All right, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Jared Krejci, and I represent the appellant, Matthew Larson. A quick factual background, this case involves the administration of an estate. The characters at issue are Matthew, who was the son of Blaine Larson. Blaine Larson had two children. The other child was Amber Fixamer, but she was left out of the will. Blaine's will basically equally divides his probate estate between Cindy Swoboda, who was his domestic partner, and Matthew Larson. Leading up to this, there was a will contest. What happened was Matthew and Amber found a note that caused them to raise some concerns. There was a will contest, and Cindy Swoboda won the will contest. So at this point, the issue is settling the estate after Cindy Swoboda won the will contest. At issue are basically three major issues. The first issue is an issue that's governed by the common law.
Before, Mr. Krejci, before you get to your assignments of error, I have a preliminary question or two. Did the court in this case ever enter an order of complete settlement? Did it ever enter an order approving a final accounting or approving the proposed schedule of distribution sought by the PR?
Your Honor, I have a hard time answering that question, and I see why you ask it, because the court's order was left a little vague as far as dollars and cents, what each devisee would be left with. And I think that's what you're getting at, Your Honor, is that the court gave us some guidance on how the county court viewed some issues of law. At the hearing that should show up on the bill of exceptions, Mr. Peets and I agreed that if the court could settle some issues of law that we disputed, some of the actual final accounting as far as dollars, cents, et cetera, could be worked out between Mr. Peets and I. But going into the hearing, we had these issues with disagreements about how the law applied. So
were the dollars and cents ever worked out? I mean, I'm familiar with where in the record you're talking about you and Mr. Peets indicating, well, we should be able to stipulate, but is there a stipulation after the court's order ruling on your objections?
No, Your Honor.
And I guess you may see where I'm going with this, but do we have a final order issue relevant to our appellate jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't brief this issue, but we are in, I believe it's called a special proceeding. And so my memory is if the county court's order affects a substantial right and we're in a special proceeding, that would qualify as a final order for appellate jurisdiction. And it's my view that this would affect a substantial right because it does finally determine certain issues as to the parties. it doesn't.
One of our standard props on whether an order affects a substantial right is whether it can be vindicated on an appeal from the final judgment. Is the final judgment in a case like this, the court's order approving complete settlement, approving the final accounting, and approving the proposed schedule of distribution?
Well, I think that's what the county court's order was attempting to do, because Mr. Peets and Cindy Swoboda filed a petition for final accounting. And that's what I objected to. And the county court gave us the order that it did. But as far as the steps that Ms. Swoboda took to try to close the estate, I think had I not objected, this the county court's order would be final and close the estate.
Okay, thank you.
Has the court entered an order authorizing the distributions and determined the costs and expenses and things of that nature? Have they done all the things that were requested in the formal petition or petition formal closing? There are still issues yet to be decided by the court.
Your Honor, I guess I can only say essentially what I said to Justice Papik, in that the court did not say dollars and cents what each devisee was entitled to in the county court's opinion, but the county court ruled on the legal issues as well as I could tell, Your Honor. There's some confusion in my mind about what the county court is saying in certain areas, but in certain issues, such as the attorney fees, the county court's very clear as to how it determined the legal issues.
What are you unclear on?
Well, I am unclear, Your Honor, about the county court essentially states that the inheritance tax should be treated through the abatement provisions of standard abatement. And I'm not entirely clear as to what the court means there. I get the impression that the court the court's ruling would order that the inheritance tax would be applied roughly 50-50. Matthew, under abatement, Matthew Larson takes 50.6% of the estate, so he's responsible for 50.6% of the expenses. So I was a little unclear about that, but as far as I think the county court, in the county court's view, it resolved all the issues.
Sorry, might that be clarified by an order that actually addresses dollars and cents, approving a final accounting?
Certainly it would, Your Honor. If I could continue going back to three issues, since I am running low on time, I did want to try to cover what I think are really the crux of the issues. The inheritance tax issue, it's our position that Nebraska's law is shown in that First National Bank of Omaha case, which was an Eighth Circuit case applying Nebraska law. If you follow that case, our position is fairly straightforward, except that the appellee does raise a bit of an interesting argument that the inheritance tax issue is controlled by the abatement statute. And I think that deserves some comment, in that abatement, the issue as to inheritance tax is not an issue. The first issue that we need to get to is whether the inheritance tax is payable from the estate, from the residue, as the will states. And abatement is not an issue unless the inheritance tax is not a debt or claim of the estate. So I did want to clarify that since there's no residue left in this estate, and the will states that the inheritance tax is paid from the residue, under the common law, under the First National Bank of Omaha case, that would mean that each devisee is responsible for their own tax. So the inheritance tax in this case is not a debt or expense of the estate.
Does the fact that the direction in the will lumps together inheritance taxes along with other funeral expenses or costs of administration, does that suggest an intent that inheritance taxes be treated as a debt of the estate along with all those other things that would be treated as a debt of the estate?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. And what I would point to is that the will, Article 2 of the will specifically says, pay the inheritance tax from my residue. So it's my position that the intent is clear that inheritance tax should be paid from the residue. In this case, there's technically no residue. So the common law applies here.
Wouldn't it always be the testator's intent that inheritance tax be paid from the residue? It's wouldn't they always intend that it would come out of what's left rather than taking it away from specific devises?
Well, I don't know if I could agree with that, Your Honor, in that what the type of will that we're looking at, the provision is common, but I don't think I could presume to say that every testator would have that desire. And in the absence of an apportionment clause like this, each devisee pays their own share. So I couldn't agree that every testator would have that intent. And I am into my rebuttal time, so I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank
you. You're muted, Mr. Peets.
Appellee is represented by Mr. Peets. Is that correct?
He's muted.
I beg your pardon?
His mic is muted.
I see.
All right. My apologies. Technology.
Mr. Peets, here, you're appearing on behalf of Appellee. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Good morning. Thanks very much. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Peets. I am the attorney representing Cindy Sobota, who is the personal representative in the matter in the estate of Blaine Larson. The scope of review, well, first off, the issue, the nature of the case is we are appealing appealing the order from the court on the closing documents, on a formal closing. And there were questions to Mr. Krejci, and I would agree with Mr. Krejci's position on this, that I do believe the court can rule on the order that the court provided.
Mr. Peets, did the court's order decide all of the issues that would be necessary to determine what the actual distribution would be? I'm really concerned about this, the potential for divisibility and wanting to get, in effect, an advisory opinion from a trial court on contested issues that still leaves undecided actual distribution issues. Could you address that?
I would, Your Honor. First off, I would agree with Mr. Krejci that we agreed at the court hearing that Matthew Larson's percentage would be 50.6 and that Cindy Sobota's percentage would be 49.4 of the final distribution of the estate after the issues were resolved by the court. And then in the court's lengthy decision, in the county court's lengthy decision, they addressed all of the issues that were presented. And the issues really fall down into three categories. One, the inheritance tax and the apportionment. Number two, some of the reasonable expenses paid by the personal representative in the course of the administration of the estate. And then the third issue was attorney's fees and fees for the personal representative. So those were the three issues, in essence, that were in all of the different assignments of error. In regard to the first issue is we do rely upon Shell quite extensively. There are three propositions of law in the Shell case that we rely upon. The first proposition in the Shell case was that the Supreme Court has previously held that a testator who wants to shift the inheritance tax burden must rely upon a combination of words that the testator desires and a few simple words might be enough to show intent. And that's cited in the Shell case, which was a 1960 case. And then there were previous cases that also supported Shell in 74, the Sidner case, the Smotlin case in 92. And then there's an older case, Naftogazer versus Cook in 65. Those are all cited in my brief. The second principle of law that we're relying upon in the Shell case is that it says, consistent with these principles, we have held that the language in a will directing the personal representative to pay my debts, expenses, and taxes is not effective apportionment clause, but we've determined that the clause expressly referring to estate inheritance taxes and directing that they be paid from the residuary estate are sufficient to supplant statutory apportionment methods. The third principle of law in Shell talks about coupling a direction to pay estate inheritance taxes with a direction to pay the testator's debts, funeral expenses, and administration costs shows the testator's intent to pay the taxes off the top. What we believe and what our proposition is that this case is a logical extension of Shell and its precedents.
There's a difference, though, Mr. Peets, wouldn't you agree, between the clause in the will in Shell and the clause in the will in this case, in that Shell talks about pay the inheritance taxes out of the probate estate, and here the will says pay the inheritance taxes out of the residue of the estate. Does that make a difference?
I think that you're correct, Your Honor, to note that that is the difference. And what we're asking for, and why I think this case is why this is the issue of law before the court for you to decide, is I think that this is a logical extension of Shell and the precedent in the Shell cases. And so I think this is an unanswered question of law because of that one word, because we do not have the word residuary. But I know in several wills I see that same language, and it's unfortunate, but it's there. I don't think that a testator knows the difference. A lot of testators really can't tell the difference between residuary and probate estate. And of course, we have all the dilemmas now with non-probate assets that's creating a lot of litigation. But so I think it is I thought about asking for a summary affirmance, but for this very issue before the court, Your Honor.
Well, does the indication that Mr. Larson wanted the inheritance taxes paid out of the residue and not the probate estate, does that not indicate that it was his desire that inheritance taxes should be paid out of what's left at the end of the process and not taken out of his specific devises of property?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think he understood the difference. If you look at the whole will, the total will, that it was really not very well written. And I would agree with the county judge, Judge Lang, in his opinion, when he basically specifically found that Shell applied and that there was enough evidence in the record that was the intent, that the inheritance taxes should be paid as an expense and off the top. I would agree with the judge on that. And I think it's a logical application. If you look at the record, it also, there was testimony by Cindy Svoboda, who also had her will that was signed right after his will, and that it was her understanding. She did not have an understanding to differentiate between the probate estate and the residuary. Now, that was not in evidence. She could not testify as to his intent because that was not admissible. That was not admissible evidence. But I think there's some value to her testimony on that same issue.
Is your position then that we should interpret this as he didn't understand what he was signing?
No. Not at all. That was what we had several depositions, Your Honor. We had several depositions and lengthy discovery and a trial on those issues. Those have been resolved by the jury.
But are you saying he didn't appreciate the difference between probate estate and residue of the estate.
I think in his, I think that it's law, it's a very logical inference from the record and from the will that estate was estate for him, that he thought that these inheritance taxes were going to be paid out of his estate. If I can go to the issue on attorney's fees, I think that the statutes apply. 30-2480, 2481, and 2482 apply on the issues of the attorney's fees for the attorneys and also for the personal representative. I think you have extensive evidence that is in the record to approve those fees. I think the judge found that the fees were reasonable. And I think that insofar as the fees and the issues of paying some of the expenses in the administration of the estate are matters that they're supported by competent evidence and that are neither arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable. I don't know if the court wants to go and try and interpret the statute on payment of some of the funeral expenses, but I do believe the record is sufficient that, and I think the court found specifically, Judge Lang found in his ruling, he specifically found that those payments were reasonable. The judge's ruling says the personal representative's testimony provides sufficient basis to find these payments were appropriate and necessary to perform her duties as a personal representative. That's at the bottom of page 3 of Judge Lang's order.
And so, that, I beg your pardon, that would include the headstone issue, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yeah. In this case, 2's better than 1.
How did the litigation counsel affect the personal representative's compensation and the attorney fees that were incurred? Was it compensation or was it devised from the decedent? How was that impacted?
I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't understand your question. Would you rephrase it, please?
Did the litigation in district court, did that impact the compensation for the personal representative?
Absolutely. I mean, the litigation in the district court extended quite a long time period. There was, you know, a failed mediation. There were several depositions, and there was a jury trial of 3 to 4 days. And one of the exhibits offered into evidence is the Judge Marroquin's finding on the matter. So this was extensive cost for the personal representative.
So counsel, is she entitled to receive personal or attorney's fees for a litigation that increases her compensation? Opposing counsel seems to argue that she's not entitled to have the estate pay the attorney's fees in that situation.
Yeah, I don't think that's consistent with our case law, nor I think that the Watkins case is very clear on that, that she's entitled to those fees. She was the proponent of the will. And if you also note in the record, Your Honor, personally, she had to employ her own personal attorney to represent her personal interest in the estate. And so, but I think the Watkins case and the Reimers case that this court decided back in 93 and 88 are consistent with the ruling by Judge Lang in the lower court.
Thank you.
Mr. Page, before you...
Are there other questions? I beg your pardon.
Just one more, if I might squeeze it in before we hear rebuttal.
You bet.
Mr. Peets, if we... Assuming that the court reaches the issues before us in this appeal, give me the short list of what's left for the county court judge to do before this wraps up.
I would ask that the court remand the matter back down to the court approve the county court's order, and then remand it with a finding for additional fees for defending the will on appeal. And I believe that that order can take conclude any issue that exists out there, including the issue of what you talked about with the schedule of distribution. Both counsel agreed and stipulated, I believe, and I'm consistent with Mr. Krejci, that the expenses should be allocated 50.6 and 49.4. So I really don't.
Did the court accept that stipulation? Did the court accept that stipulation and make a factual finding, or is that just what the parties had agreed to?
The parties agreed to it, and I don't believe that the court objected to it. But I understand where the appellate court's coming from in this situation.
Thank you.
I think there are no more questions, Mr. Peets. I think your time has concluded. Thank you. And
thank you.
We return to Mr. Krejci and for rebuttal. And I'm going to ask the bailiff to add another 2 minutes to his time.
Thank you, Your Honor. To get back to where Mr. Peets left off, as far as the stipulation that we were discussing, off the top of my head, I can't tell you whether the court formally accepted that stipulation, but we did do that in open court, and it should be in the Bill of Exceptions. Now, to go back more into the issues, Your Honor, as far as the intent, when we're getting to the Shell case and the inheritance tax, when construing wills, the intent of the testator is supposed to, absent some type of ambiguity, mistake, et cetera, it's supposed to come from the will. And the will says, paid the inheritance tax from my residue. So I don't think that no issue of mistake, ambiguity, et cetera, has been raised below. To go to attorney fees, in briefing, the parties essentially boiled down to, in this case, as the way that 302481 and the comment applies in this case with whether the compensation of the personal representative and whether the litigation solely benefited the personal representative's compensation. Through briefing, we've essentially boiled down to that the issue in deciding this issue is, what does compensation mean? And the appellee's position is that compensation means personal representative fees. It's our position that compensation does not only mean personal representative fees, and it means compensation in the broader sense of what is inherited under the will. And in this case, had Cindy Larson lost the will contest, she would have not received anything under the will. She essentially steps into Amber Fixamer's, the other child's, shoes under the will. And
could her primary purpose in defending the will contest be not to increase her own compensation, but to essentially try to effectuate what she believes to be the testator's intent as reflected in a valid will?
Your Honor, that was what the county court found. And based on, this is going to other UPC jurisdictions that I cite in my brief. There's a New Mexico case that I cite in my brief that says an intent to merely affect the testator's intent and defend a will is not good faith. And the reason, if you look at this Rorich case that I believe is from North Dakota, which is another UPC jurisdiction, the reason for that is because a personal representative is a fiduciary. And the personal representative owes a duty to follow the instructions of the successors. A personal representative does not have any duty to defend a will if the successors do not want the will to be probated. So merely, Ms. Svoboda's opinion, trying to vindicate Blaine Larson's wishes, that in itself is a sole reason for seeking to probate a will is not a sufficient good faith, because it ignores Matthew Larson's position. And she, as a fiduciary, she is supposed to take that into account. So based on the other UPC cases.
Chris, I beg your pardon. I think your time is up. And unless there are questions from the other members of the court, are there questions? No, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You're excused.